Brainstorm Brewery is brought to you by GatheringMagic.com and CoolStuffInc.com. Show your support.
Yeah, Chapin listed it on his top five blue cards.
Oh, Chapin's wrong so much, though. Like, the whole finance community knows not to listen to him. Seriously, and then he gets salty about it. He's like, how could you guys not buy Jason Architect of Thought when I told you that, you know, because when it hit 50, he's like, I told you guys at 30. I'm like, yeah, but you say everything. You know, you told me to buy a bunch of copies of, what was it, Curse of Echoes. I didn't do it, but like he said to.
That card got played.
It did. As a one of. Yeah, Curse of Echoes is really funny when you curse them and then they're like, Sphinx's Revelation, you're like, hang on, let me draw first. Oh, there's my counterspell.
Alright, let's do this podcast thing.
Yeah, I like the occasional low risk spec, because if that card gets, like, you were partially responsible for making Desecration Demon go from 25 cents to $7, so.
That card's $7?
Yeah. Also, Jason, it was never 25 cents. Don't exaggerate. You're the worst ever. God, you think you're funny, too.
It's actually $8 a paper. Damn.
Yep. Wow. Except I did buy them at 25 cents. Everyone's like, oh, TCG Mid. They go and look at a graph, and they're like, well, TCG Mid was never below this. And I'm like, okay, I didn't pay fucking TCG Mid, ass face. Like,
yeah, I bought a bunch at a dime. Like, people come in the store, I guess I'll buy those from
you. You want to see my fucking receipts? Like, shut up.
Look, everyone's an expert. That's why I hate the people that act like experts but like have anonymous usernames. I'm like, look, my username is my name. So like, yeah. I'm being a jagoff as myself.
You cannot convert 100% of people.
Yeah, well, I try.
Okay, so let's podcast.
Yeah.
This is Brainstorm Brewery, episode number 71.
Yep.
And we got a special guest here. We got the first person ever to have the balls to write for brainstormbrewery.com.
Possibly the last.
Possibly the last, not. Hopefully we got more. We got Raymond. Shout out to Future Ray.
Future Ray.
Out there at the PT.
Pro Future Ray.
Pro Future Ray. I'm sorry. Future Ray, pro man.
Yeah, but I bet Ray's really excited too. Esper control's real good.
Yeah, I like it. I think it's well positioned. Anything who stinks as Revelation is going to be doing that, so that card's not going to see any stop. But Jeff Hoogland, you want to tell people who you are and a little bit more about you? I'm sure they read the writing that they followed Brainstorm Brewery, but, you know, and SCG, you're all over there, so tell us about it.
I just play a whole ton of Constructed Magic in the Midwest, Modern, Legacy, Standard. Had a really good run this year on the SCG Open Circuit. Like 7 or 8 top 8s and then one invitational top 8. Managed to sneak into top 16 by mistake at GP Kansas City. So that was sweet. Yeah, so that's a fun story. So I sat down with my last round opponent at GP Kansas City and we're like, okay, so we're going to draw into top 32, right? And we drew, but 4 of the people, 2 of whom I had beaten, 2 of whom I'd lost to, were above me in the rankings still. So I had really good tiebreakers. It stuck into 16th at like X3-1.
Nice.
So you didn't do the math on that one like you did with this spreadsheet that you shot us. We're going to have this in the show notes. He actually did a spreadsheet where he breaks down the relevant creatures being played in Standard and what removal they die to. And it's pretty interesting. Is there anything that you want to share with people that they should highlight about the spreadsheet you did?
One thing that I thought was really interesting is that 2 of the top 10 most played creatures from this first weekend of Standard have protection from white, which makes things like Chain to the Rocks and Warleader's Helix significantly worse as choices for removal. Those 2 creatures are the Stormbreath Dragon and then Blood Baron of Viscopa.
Yeah, I was in the testing, like, protection from white's huge. Like, it's a lot of things that it stops. It's like Turn and Burn is the only way to deal with, you know, those creatures as it is right now.
Yeah, Turnburn, from my data, was definitely the most consistent kill spell. If you get up to 5 mana for it, it kills 92% of the creatures that saw play last weekend.
Oh, I love math and spreadsheets. Awesome.
Yeah, he won all Sabermetrics on this shit.
So what do you think about the new Hellkite? Do you think that's going to be played as much? Do you think it's going to be a factor? And if so, how much of a factor?
I think that that card's definitely going to at least maintain its value for a little while until some more copies flood the market. It depends on how much that set gets drafted, obviously, but it's going to be probably as popular as Thundermaw Hellcat. It's a very, very similar effect.
Like, yeah, I missed the boat hard on that one.
No, there was never a good time to buy in.
They're 25. Well,
that's fair, but like it was 25, and I said it's going to be 15 before it's 35, and now it's 35.
I'd be willing to bet it's going to do like Thunderball and bubble up to 50, 55, and then settle back down probably around the 30 where it started.
Damn, really? Okay.
It's really just like, cause the card, it's a protection from white, and just in this particular format is what matters. I mean, cause the card itself is, you know, obviously much worse than Thunderball until you factor in that protection from white stops everything, including like Azorius Charm, which isn't even played because of it in Voice of Resurgence at this point.
I don't know if not being in a core set, it could ever hit like 50, 55 the way Thunderball did. Because, like, being in a core set was one of the real factors behind Thundermaw.
Bonfire?
Hey. I'll tell you the bubble we did miss, though, was that Chandra. That one kind of just really bites kind of right now.
Chandra feels like it's, like, disproportionately high for, like, the amount of play it's seeing. Like, it's seeing play as a ton of two-of and stuff, but, like, it doesn't seem like $35 good. Is that just me?
No, you're right.
Nobody opened in 14. When I went back through last week and like reviewed my set review on QS from 14, it's like I felt like my predictions were good and I basically nailed the amount of play that a lot of the cards were seeing, but they're just higher prices than they were last year. Like Archangel of Thune sees about as much play as
Angel of Serenity. Sublime Archangel, yeah.
Yeah, it sees about as much play, but it's $10 more.
I mean, I do see, you know, Archangel of Thune probably being respecting the cost of for what it's worth. But Chandra's probably on a bubble right here because I think a lot of speculation is going on. And I think more people are in the market actually speculating on cards, and that's causing this card to go up because people don't want to miss the boat. And they feel this could be another, you know, $50 card just because that's bound to happen somewhere.
I think nobody opened 14.
The fact that it just saw play in like the Modern Grand Prix as like a one of in all of these decks, and then the fact that it saw play in like Ruben Bressler's Legacy deck, have people thinking like maybe this could be the next great Planeswalker, but I mean it's fine. It's just fine though. It's not amazing.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean I liked this card when it came out, and I was a little, I mean I got my playset and everything, so that was no problem. But I didn't really spec in this because I was just uncertain. Too many people were down on it, and I mean the card, you know, it's not really card draw, but at the same time it does give red a pseudo card draw, so it's a powerful effect in red if you're not splashing blue. And just, you know, four mana Planeswalker has potential, but I think the hype behind it is a little bit more than where the card is actually going to be positioned standard.
Yeah. I mean, like we said, I think the important thing to keep in mind financially is that, like you said, the card is fine. It's not amazing. It's fine. But M14 was so little open, and that's why it cost so much, whether it was a hangover for Modern Masters or just because the set wasn't exciting or what. The numbers across the board are backing up that cards from M14 just did not drop as much as similar cards from M13, which means that if something starts being played from M14 that is currently not expensive, like the ceiling is going to be higher on it. I think that's really the relevant thing moving forward to keep in mind.
One thing I want to talk about, Matty Studios on Heavy Meta, he brought this up, and we were just going back and forth about Liliana the Veil. It was at 52, I believe, and I said I sold out. And he was like, oh no, I'm going to hold on. You know, I want to keep my cards. And I was like, you know, it's going to go down before rotation. And so it went down to 40, but then it shot back up and it's at 57 right now. And the same thing for some other, the Avacyn Restore cards. You know, we got, Crystal Brand's now 22 on Moto. You're starting to see Sigarda going up. It seems like, you know, post rotation cards are not going to hit the bottom like they used to. It seems like there's more people in the market that are actually speculating on cards, and that we might not see the actual bottom post rotation, but you know, people are starting to buy up cards before that even happens. So I don't know if this is going to be a change in the market or something, but it's just something interesting to look at.
If you look back, and you know, this is what people say a lot, you know, obviously there's the rotation dip, and I've written before about how basically the rotation dip is a myth at this point. All the drop in cards comes in the summer. By the time you hit rotation, people understand that they're bottomed out, and they start getting back in. Even going back to Zendikar, if you look at the fetch lands, those all started at 20 or whatever, and they worked their way down to like 8 to 10 during the summer, right before rotation, and then rotation hits, they're at $10, and they never move. You know, so like the rotation dip to me is a myth. You know, outside of like bulk rares or you know near bulk rares.
Cards that are modern playable are going to change that too now, though. I mean, like, using your Zendikar example, modern didn't really exist as a format, and extended didn't see nearly the support that modern does.
That's true.
Right, yeah. And the price didn't go down then, so there's no way they're going to go down now.
Yeah,
I think it's interesting that you said Sigarda was going back up. Grizzlebrand sees play in obviously a variety of legacy decks, and it's getting pseudo-popular in modern with that Anderson did a video series with the Grizzlebrand Reanimator deck. So it makes sense that that card's gaining some traction, but Sigarda doesn't make sense to me.
I think it's EDH.
It's a casual card. Angels are always going to be...
I forget casual's a format.
Yeah, and it's Avacyn Restored. It's another small format that was barely open that people hated, so...
Casual's actually a thing on Moto.
No, but they're not big on Moto, and this card doing good has been a mystery to me the entire time. Like, I got it, and I sold mine off at 12. For some reason, it was 12 at some point in Standard, even though it's seen absolutely no play whatsoever. And I think the Angel Theory holds on Moto as well, because this card never really dipped below 7 or 5, really. Yeah, I think it went down to 5 post-rotation, and that's like one of the more expensive cards that they had in the set of Avacyn Restored, despite seeing absolutely no Standard play, no Modern play, no Legacy play. So.
Well, it saw a little Standard play right after rotation in those like green white Gavinny Township decks. It saw a little bit, and that's what caused the paper spike. I think it's probably EDH though, because EDH is on Moto, right?
Yeah, but it's horrible. Like, Moto is already not the greatest interface, and then you got 4 people playing, not interacting, you know, verbally. Like, I don't know. I just EDH experience on Moto does not seem like the way to go. But I'm sure there's probably a crowd because this card is doing well there. But yeah. So Jeff, on Moto, you stream. How often do you stream, and what's
So right now I've been doing free GP Detroit. I was streaming Modern 2 to 3 times a week. For the last couple of weeks, I've just been doing once a week since there's not a large Modern event for another month or so. Starting next week when Theros is online, I'm gonna start doing Standard once or twice a week and still do Modern once a week.
So Jeff, how long have you been in streaming? I mean, you know, how did you get into it? What's your experience been like, and what can people expect, you know, when they come to your stream?
So for a long time, I was very against double investing in Magic Online cards, so I held off from starting Moto. But about a month ago, I recently moved, and one of my new roommates had a bunch of blue-red stuff on Moto, so it was fairly cheap for me to finish out the blue-red Delver deck that I've been playing for a long time. So I rounded that out, and I figured if I was going to be playing Magic Online, I might as well let other people that found it interesting watch. So basically, you know, we just hang out and I play Magic and talk about the plays that I'm going to make. I get a lot of comments from people. Apparently, most streamers don't talk about why they're making the lines that they're making, but that never made sense to me. Like, if you're going to be showing other people what you're doing, if you're not going to talk about it, what's the point of watching?
Well, I think that's how, you know, with, like, draft videos, kind of that predated streaming, and then streaming itself, I think the idea behind it was you're supposed to be explaining your plays to people so they get better. And at some point, streaming kind of became just more of a hangout where people are just interacting with their viewers but not trying to teach.
Yeah.
So you're saying you'd rather just learn and have the whole process. And how do you feel that you have grown from this streaming experience?
Well, you definitely understand the things you're doing when you talk about them more. Like when you sit there and talk about, well, if I take this line, my outs are this, but if I take this other line, I have like this many things, or if he has this, then if you really think that through out loud, it helps you make the better line more often, I think.
Okay. What about the people that you have in your chat? How helpful are they, and are they toxic at all?
So you're going to find toxic people anywhere you go on the internet. The key is avoiding the idiots and not being afraid to tell them when they're an idiot.
Oh, so we heard that you're quite rude on your streams. You got a name that people associated with you with?
I had a few people tell me that I was more rude than Michael Jacobson, but they were very wrong, and they felt they were very right.
Wow, that's a tall cup of water right there. Oh, man.
There's probably some Dutch idiom right there, Marcel. That's what I thought you were going for.
So this first week of Standard, I thought it was really interesting. Usually we see all the aggressive strategies come out on top, and Mono Red did win the 10K, but I'm sure a lot of people weren't aware, because I wasn't aware until I looked. There was a TCG player 5K this past weekend too, and a blue-white control deck actually won that event.
See, you say it's interesting. Like, to me, I was looking at block decks with a couple cards from Theros, Like, it felt just like rehashes. I mean, do you think that was just a product of it being the first weekend, or do you think, like, that's just kind of what we're going to end up with?
I don't know. There was definitely a stunning lack of innovation across the board, but if you look at the deck lists from the 5K, you'll see that they're most of them are very similar to the deck lists that did well at the 10K. So the archetypes that are represented there are probably going to be represented throughout most of the season, I would think.
Mm-hmm. So get in early, get your cards early, because they're going to be players.
It's a tough sell, too, because, like, if you remember back to during when Blue-White Delver was dominant, like, that deck started out with Phantasmal Bears and Runechanter's Pike, so, like, there's no doubt that the best deck hasn't been found yet, if there is one.
Of course.
Right. I mean, the Blue-White, like, the Blue-White or the Esper, even the Mono Red, like, those decks all existed in block. You know, nobody's changed anything. They just added some Theros cards they thought were good. And, I mean, honestly, taking a tuned deck and making the obvious adjustments is probably like the best way to win money in the first weekend of an event. I mean, there's not a reward even if you do have the innovation, you know, like a lot of people who may innovate are saving it for the Pro Tour. Whereas, you know, everyone else who may be innovating doesn't necessarily have the same level of testing going into it. So, I mean, it definitely makes sense that those tried and true strategies do well in the first weekend.
Yeah, that's true. I would be interested to find out from someone that was at like the TCG Player 5K, what kind of decks were being played in the room, because the thing I found really interesting was there wasn't any mono red in their top 16, whereas there were four copies of it in the Star City top 16.
Deck seems very powerful.
I mean, so what?
Some version of it.
Jeff, what have you seen that maybe isn't these decks that we expected? I mean, you know, in your testing that, you know, you want to talk about, or, you know, you've seen people brewing that you actually think has a chance of being good, kind of with a, you know, some more unconventional strategy.
I think the biggest surprise was that, more aggressive three-color decks like the Naya aggro or mid-range deck were still viable with the rotation of all of the buddy lands. I think a lot of people were expecting those to just fall on their face, but there were several deck lists, like, in the top results of both, so obviously it's going to be a consistent strategy that's worth playing.
What do you think about the impact of the new Skylands?
The new Skylands are better than a lot of people give them credit for. We've honestly just been spoiled for the last 2 years with, like, the quality of the mana fixing that we have.
That's fair. I mean, they're pretty much all going to see play. People boohooing about them, they're just delaying the inevitable that they're going to be playing with these cards.
No, yeah, definitely. I mean, like, I'm planning on playing a blue-red controlling deck this weekend in the Star City event in Cleveland, and I'm playing four Guildgates in the deck because there aren't temples in my color, so you better believe that when I get the Skylands in those colors, like, they slot in as a strict upgrade.
I mean, I'm happy with, like, I love the ability to scry off of my land. I mean, it helps you with if he keeps, it helps you, you know, pretty much in any phase of the game. Given that, you're not going to have a better option. Like, you need the double mana. So, like, it's either Guildgate or Skyland, and I'm happy to scry. If, you know, like you said, I think it does go back to people just being spoiled and expecting it to be easier.
But, so how do you think this is going to impact three-color decks in general? Is this going to make the aggro decks less viable? I mean, you're saying that that's not the case right now, but do you see that playing out as the standard progresses into deeper format?
The thing about the Skylands is, and any things that come into play tapped and like slow down your tempo or curve, is the more of those that see play, the better aggressive decks like mono red or green red aggro deck that are like consistent early pressure will do.
One thing.
Oh my god! I'm so sorry, everyone. We want to apologize for Corbin banging his spoon into his mic, and you could hear Jason typing across the entire internet. Yeah, he's got ice cream. His ice cream is more important than podcasting with you.
I didn't know it was hurt, man.
Really?
I didn't know what was coming through. I thought I was eating silently.
you're ice cream ninja. That's right. But anyway.
Speaking of ice cream, Jeff's got a pretty interesting Isochron Scepter deck for Modern he's brewed up.
Oh, my God.
Oh, man.
We weren't going to talk about that, but the opportunity for the perfect segue presented itself, and I leapt on it. Jeff, why don't you tell us a little bit about Ice Cream Scepter?
So, first everyone asked about the name, and it's just one of those simple, like the name Nick Fit came from a typo. One of my buddies, we were messaging about the deck, talking about card ideas, and his autocorrect went from Isochron to Ice Cream somehow. So we've been calling it the Ice Cream Scepter deck. Huh. But basically, it's just, it's a blue-white-red, I'd say Delver burn deck. We get to play a whopping, like, 40 points of, reach in the main deck with Boros Charm and Lightning Bolt and Lightning Helix and Magma Jet. And occasionally, you get to strap one of those pieces of doming to an Isochron Scepter.
Okay, so that's the obvious stuff. Can we talk about a few of the less conventional choices?
So, everyone always says, like, I've been streaming with the deck, and the question I always get is, oh my god, how can you play Isochron Scepter in an Abrupt Decay format? Well, for starters, Owen Turtenwald told everyone that they shouldn't be playing Abrupt Decay in their Jund deck. That being said, even if they are playing Abrupt Decay, we get to play like 9 cards in our deck, 6 of which are in the main deck that get to actually counter or stop Abrupt Decay. Boros Charm has a mode that gives things indestructible, which is a sweet way to counter an Abrupt Decay. And then, Apostle's Blessing is, my current spell of choice for surprise counters. That's it's a common out of NPH that can give an artifact or creature you control protection from the color of your choice till end of turn.
Ooh, sick.
You've got Redirect in your board, which I think is hilarious.
Yes.
If they're going to try to Abrupt Decay your Scepter.
Redirecting from your Scepter to, like, their Tarmogoyf or their Liliana is very, very sweet.
Tell me what, you know, I think it was maybe not last season, maybe it was even this season before, but there was a time where Isochron Scepter kind of broke out in Modern and people were all over it and then it kind of fell off and stopped being played. I mean, what caused that? And, you know, do you think it's, you know, now the time's right for it to come back?
You know, I'm not super familiar with the time you're talking about, but I think the deck that I've been working with is decently well positioned. The fact that we get to play 12 pieces of removal in the main deck plus Snapcaster Mages means we have really good creature matchups. Like, most of the creature decks in the format can't beat Lightning Helix attached to an Isochron Scepter, like just killing something every turn or like having a 6-point life swing every turn.
I played the deck back then. There were a few key cards that we didn't have and that made the deck really bad without Scepter. We didn't have Snapcaster Mage, Delver of Secrets, Spellskite for part of it. So without the reach you get from Delver, you were just a deck that was really, really bad without Scepter. And looking at Jep's list, I think you're not really, really bad without Scepter. If you never drew it, you're still sticking a Delver, playing a bunch of value. Flipping the Delver.
Yeah, the deck before was kind of like a red, white, blue control deck with Scepter, except I don't think Sphinx's Revelation was a thing yet.
No, so you're running Path to Exile, Helix. I ran one research and development for the Lulz. Like, it ran Vendilion Click, but again, you didn't have Delver at the time, so it was just, if you did draw your Scepter, you just had a bunch of really silly stuff that wasn't great.
Yeah, like you said, it was basically the red, white, blue control deck with Isochron Scepter, but no Sphinx's Revelation. So if you didn't draw Scepter, you had very little card advantage in the deck.
One thing you'll note about my deck list is that all the Path to Exiles are in the sideboard, and that's something I have to explain to people a lot because they don't get it right away. Is in a deck that's trying to play Spell Pierce and Mana Leak, like, you don't want to be ramping your opponent. It's really bad playing, like, ramp my opponent with my soft counter game.
So do you take those out and put the Paths in?
Yeah, the Paths come in against decks where counter magic typically isn't very good, like Tarmogoyf decks and other things that are playing things like Loxodon Smiter that you need to kill with Path. Like, you get to board Spell Pierces out in those matchups because they just aren't very good.
Okay, guys, so if you're interested in, did you write up a sideboarding guide with the article you submitted, Jeff?
I didn't write a hard and fast sideboarding guide because your sideboard should be flexible based on the metagame you're expecting.
Sure. Okay. Jeff actually wrote up an article for brainstormbrewery.com about this deck, so we'll go ahead and get that up for you. So by the time you're hearing this podcast, it'll be posted.
Sweet.
Yeah, I can't wait to play with that. You know, I've been waiting to dip back into Modern for a little while, and that sounds like my type of deck.
Yeah, Scepter is one of my favorite cards ever, and the fact that someone finally found a way to make it playable is exciting to me.
Yeah.
That does sound like a cool Modern deck. If it had some more Merfolk in it, I might consider it.
Ooh.
So speaking of back to Theros cards and Modern and Merfolk, let's tie it all together. Thassa could be a very good card in Modern Merfolk.
You know, I thought about that a little bit.
Like you don't want a bunch of them, but like as a two of, like Lord Thassa, your opponent's going to die very quickly.
Yeah. Thassa's a pretty sweet card. I really like that Scry. Like, I really want to play with that in Standard, trying to brew some decks with that.
If you draw a land late with Merfolk, you just feel like a total donkey.
I feel like if I ever draw 5, I mean, that's why I'm down to 8. I play 18 lands in mine, and
that's
I don't.
That's so greedy.
Well, I mean, there is no, I don't, all, I only run Spell Pierce. I run 4 3 drops, and that's it. Like, it's like the very aggro Merfolk, and it's 18 or 19 lands. But like, yeah, I feel like if I ever draw 5 or more lands, I'm dead.
So,
that's why I just kept cutting.
One thing that's interesting that I like to talk about, because you're talking about how good scrying is in some decks, is that, the scry effect isn't very good in some of the more controlling decks like the blue-white deck, where they just don't have bad cards in their deck a lot of the time. And by that I mean, you don't want to always be scrying away land, because even when it's your, you know, 9th or 10th land drop, you want to be making those land drops so you can cast giant revelations.
Yeah, that's
makes
good.
Sense. Yeah.
I was testing for my blue control, and I sometimes I would just, because I'm just playing on, like, Magic Workstation, sometimes I forget to scribe with it, and I'm like, you can just draw the card first, and I'm like, oh, okay, well, whatever. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, very rarely are you digging for anything in particular.
But if you ever do get to the deck where you redo it, I mean, scrying away a land is like drawing a card almost sometimes.
In Merfolk, absolutely.
Yeah, so.
I mean, I think maybe it even, it may depend on your Merfolk build. I guess we can stop saying Merfolk, just like your deck in general. If your deck's really aggressive, sometimes playing nothing, do nothing on turn three, the turn it comes into play is not very good. So like I can see an argument against it, but it just depends on your build. Like if you're the more counter magic heavy Merfolk builds, I think would benefit from it more than like a, all out vapor stag type build.
Thassa actually seems pretty easy to turn on, which is something that
I don't know if you consider,
because like all your lords are going to be double blue, so three dudes will flip that.
Yeah, but you're usually doing that. Well, two lords flips it. Two lords flips it.
Yeah, because it has one for itself.
Yeah.
I mean, but usually having two lords means you're winning anyways. Like, and those are the only. I mean, Tidebinder Mage is double blue, but you're like, yeah, I can see games where you go like Cursecatcher into lord into dude into Thassa, and then the next turn you're swinging with it.
I don't think Tidebinder Mage is constructed playable in any format.
Really? Nice.
That's not true.
What? Name me a situation where you want Tidebinder Mage.
They have a Tarmogoyf, right? And then you tap it.
Yes.
And then they...
Listen to me. If you're playing against, if you're playing against the removal heavy decks, like if you're playing against Jund, okay, like Merfolk's probably not good right now because the Jund matchup's not great because they have all the removal, right?
Yeah.
But there's a lot of times where, like if you're playing Merfolk and you're playing against Jund, they kill a bunch of your guys, and you draw a lord off the top, you're like, crap, they have a Tarmogoyf and I have a 2-2. And you have to have this critical mass that you're not going to reach against removal heavy decks. Tidebinder Mage actually does that.
Why is that better than Kira Glass Spinner?
Cause Kira doesn't stop to Abrupt Decay for one, but like, I also run one Kira, but like also it's a Merfolk. It's a 2-drop. I mean,
Death Rite Shaman tap too.
It's incredibly important against Kitchen Finks, I'll tell you that much, because Kitchen Finks was, and I mean, Kitchen Finks has kind of fallen out of favor now, you know, several months ago before Deathrite Shaman kind of took over the format completely. Like, Kitchen Finks was all over the place, and Tidebinder Mage was huge against Kitchen Finks. Like, Pod would play Kitchen Finks against you, and you would just be dead because it's going to trade with at least one of your guys, and they're still going to get all their value out of it, and just put such a wall in front of you, and you Tidebinder Mage Kitchen Finks, and you're good to go. So, like, those
until they sack it.
Sure, but like that's fine because you got to attack, which is the point.
Like not even just second, but like Restoration Angel it.
Yeah, but like
that burns.
Anyways, and it doesn't matter. It doesn't like.
I don't know why we're letting Corbin talk about Merfolk for so long.
I mean,
well, he hasn't had the chance in like how long? So Jeff, just tell him Merfolk
sucks. It's like a legitimate conversation. Like before, you had Korahelm Commander, which is fine and good and everything, but like Korahelm Commander didn't help you on turn two against Pod. And Tidebinder Mage does. So like, I have two in the main deck and two in the sideboard. And it gets the first card to get boarded out against the rep decks it's not good against. And it's the first card to come in against the decks it is good against.
So do you buy this, Jeff? Are you going to play Merfolk in Modern now?
I might actually, I mean like, I'm looking for something different to play at the 50k than the blue-red Delver deck. So I'm going to definitely give some kind of Merfolk a try with Thassa. And like, I might try Tidebinder Mage some more. It just seems so bad on paper. Like, yeah, I've got this thing that, like, taps the Tarmogoyf, but look, could just
death
be another... Deathrite.
If they can't kill it, you're going to keep their Deathrite tap down, and that's going to give them some heartburn, I think.
Is it really better than another Lord, though? Like, can I just play, like, all the Lords?
I don't know.
Cutting Lords. Like, you're cutting, like Phantasmal Image, which is not always a Lord, or you're cutting, like, Mana Leaks, or some of that, those filler cards that aren't necessary.
But, like, okay, you cut Phantasmal Image for a card that answers Tarmogoyf, like, Phantasmal Image could just be Tarmogoyf if it's not a Lord.
But it dies to everything. Whereas like your Tidebinder Mage does, but the important thing is that your Tidebinder Mage allows you to swing. And in the build of Merfolk that I have, which is the very aggressive version, all you want is that turn. Like, you lock it down, if they answer it, they're not killing the Lord, but it's, they kill them on turn 5 or 6 Merfolk, not the counter stuff and kill them on turn 8 or 9 or, you know, whatever as the game goes on. Like, that's kind of the difference. And I think it probably shines in those decks where the tempo it gains you is bigger than just having a dude that's better on paper. That's probably the best way I can say it.
This is from a veteran Merfolk player that has tried his entire Brainstorm Brewery career to make Merfolk Modern a thing. So he
you
might
know what actually about. I had two buddies that both top 32 GP Kansas City playing Merfolk.
Boom.
Whoa.
Right there.
What if he makes this a thing Oh man, you would make Corbin's day. Like, you would be his hero.
If he got to be right just one time on this podcast.
Well, oh, yeah.
Imagine Merfolk's Crisis, and it becomes a new modern deck, and all of a sudden it takes down Giant.
Very realistic about it. It's good against Untuned decks. You take it to a room like GP Detroit, I don't think you're gonna do great, because those Jund decks are really difficult for Merfolk.
You know what though? I mean, like, you're talking about the problem is, like, expecting to play a single deck more than twice in a modern GP, that's ridiculous. Like, the format's so diverse.
Well, that's fair.
Yeah, if you look, the day two of GP Detroit, there were something like 39 archetypes in the tournament at the start of day two. Now, there were three at the end of day two, but, when they cut the top eight, it was like GBX plus one robots deck plus one pod deck who eventually won.
And, I mean, there's a lot of decks that Merfolk just runs over and it punishes people for greedy keeps. I mean, like, there's rooms where it's not good because there's decks it is very, very much not favored against. But you can just steamroll through a tournament if you play tight and kind of draw the right matchups. And I mean, it's a thing. Like, it punishes people.
That's all eternal formats. Like, yeah. You want to draw that allows you to punish people, and you want to have matchups that you win, but you're always going to have matchups that you lose.
Okay. Well, it sounds like Jeff thinks that Merfolk might be a decent pick. Speaking of picks, how about we get on to pick of the week?
Man, you're worse than me. Holy crap. I thought I was bad.
I actually spent 3 hours with Marcel locked in a room, and he taught me how to segue.
He took the Marcel's free 99. Learned how to segue like a...
It was the Miyagi method. It was weird. He's like, just keep waxing my car, Jason, then you'll learn how to segue. And I was like, all right. How is vacuuming your living room teaching me to segue? And he's just like, just do it.
No, waxing my car, because I actually don't have a car. So, yeah.
Whose car did I wax?
It's funny that we're talking about Merfolk, because I'm looking at MTG stocks and curse catchers on the greatest gainers for the day.
Oh.
Random fact.
Speaking of greatest gainers, I'll go first on pick of the week. How is Chandra's Phoenix a dollar on eBay?
Because you should buy it.
How is it a $1.40 on hot sauce? How's the TCG low $1.50? Like,
it got printed three times?
Yeah, sure, it did, but...
About the promo, by the way, being the third.
Yeah, like there was the box topper or whatever. Yeah. I think Chandra's Phoenix has some real room to grow, and I think some of the websites, it's already up to $4 on Amazon. You know, Channel Fireball jumped the price from $2 to $3 in the last week, so I think Chandra's Phoenix could be a $5 card despite all the printings, based on how good the red decks are, and how good it is with Chandra. So as Chandra goes up, I think the Phoenix goes up along with it.
What about Ash Zealot, which is also right there? I mean, like, MTG stocks, Chandra's Phoenix and Ash Zealot are the top two gainers over the last day or two. I mean, how high do you think they go?
I think Ash Zealot's probably got some more room to grow just based on the fact that it hasn't been printed as much.
Yeah, I mean, it's sitting at $3 right now.
I like Ash Zealot at $2.50. You know, you can buy them for $2 on eBay. Why not?
Chandra's Phoenix is $1.63 or $1.84 for the M4 version. And you could have picked this up for 5 cents if you would have listened to me about, was it 4 months ago or 3 months ago?
Oh, I have a box full of them for sure. Like when I heard it was getting reprinted, I picked them up, which seemed dumb, but I really thought that it would get play.
Yeah, I mean, it was cheap that like it didn't matter. I mean, they weren't expensive.
If Purphoros takes off, this is, you know, likely to be a $4 card on Moto. Because I mean, you could recur it and it does double the damage. So it'd be pretty sick. We'll see if that's actually going to be a fact.
I think there's almost arbitrage opportunity if you can buy Chandra's Phoenix around $1.50, though. There's got to be some buy list that's going to be like $2 or $2.50 in the next few weeks.
So hold up. Let's ask our resident pro here, Jeff, weigh in on this Chandra Phoenix. What do you think?
It really depends on, you know, how greedy the mana bases are, how long Mono Red is able to stay popular. Like we said, the more of the Scrylands that see play, the better they'll be.
Yeah, Burning Earth is just it's on a beating right now.
Yeah.
Like, you were talking about how you were surprised that Naya deck got there, and Burning Earth really punishes that. And then Marcel was saying the word speaking. I think I cut him off mid-segue, which is another trick he taught me while I was back in his living room.
Speaking of Burning Earth, thank you for taking my pick of the week, because on Moto is still only $1.25. You can find it, and yeah, you should just buy copies of this, because... people are going to try to jam three color decks, and you're going to have to punish them. And even though there's going to be a lot of enchantment removal and enchantment hate, this card is as powerful as you can make it, because if you got your deck correctly, it's not symmetrical. So, you know, I just think this card is undervalued at $1, and I could see it at least doubling. if not reaching the $3 to $4 range.
What is it in paper? Do you happen to know, Marcel?
It's $3.82, which I think has a lot less room to go and move around. I mean, it could be maybe a $6 card, but I don't know.
I was actually surprised. I went to pick those up. I was surprised they were that high. It just doesn't seem like they see as much play. They didn't see a ton of play at the end of last season.
Yeah, you would think they would see more play there.
The open, like that mono red deck crush, there were two decks running Burning Earth in the top eight.
And it's also hard for mono red at the end of the season. There's so much in life gain going on, and Thrag Test is putting like a nail in the coffin in any mono red strategy, I think.
You know, Thrag Test being, and then that new Flame Tongue Kevu, the 4/2 that like hits their face for their devotion to red. Like, I misread that card. I thought it hit creatures. So I was like, I slammed that in limited, and then I read it. I was like, oh, it hits the face. That's terrible. But it's not terrible in constructed. Like, limited, you want to hit their creatures, but man, in constructed, like, having that thing hit somebody for 7 is just brutal. And Estelle, it really, powers it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting how different, a few people have written about this week, how different the mono red decks were in the top 8. Like, one was playing Mutavaults, but the deck list that won was like all in on the Burning Tree Emissary, Ashzella, Boros Reckoner to maximize that 4-drop.
Yeah, that's very cool. I like that strategy. Corbin, do you have a mono red card to discuss your pick of the week?
Mono red.
Mono red Merfolk.
Mono red. Gosh, they made red Merfolk. Anyways,
Tie Binder Mage.
You're right. No, I actually am going to do something we don't do often, I guess, but it kind of addresses some concerns I've heard. And that is, I'm going to put a hold call on Blood Baron of Viscopa. I mean, this is a card I've been advocating for since it was like $8, because I just saw how much play it was seeing at the Pro Tour, and then in the block decks after that. It was all over. So now looking at it, it is $16. And what we know about Dragon's Maze is that Dragon's Maze was not open at all because the Modern Masters coming and interrupting. So a lot of people have been asking, oh, hey, should I sell? Should I sell? And, you know, usually when you double up on a card like this, I'd say, oh yeah, absolutely sell. But I think this could go to 20 to 25 at the Pro Tour because it's so good. Like, we talked about how good protection from white is. You know, this has protection from white and black thrown in. It's got lifelink. It is a brick wall to a lot of decks. And, I think that's pretty huge. So like, this is a card that even though it's already spiked and gone up, and I hope you have them like we suggested, but I don't think it's time to sell quite yet. Maybe if you have enough and you've doubled up on them, sell half so you got your money back and then wait and see what happens with the other half. But this is a card I can see hitting 20 to 25.
We talked about my spreadsheet a little bit earlier that was talking about which creatures died to what. Blood Baron dies to 3 out of 17 pieces of common removal in the format right now.
Wow. So Mizzium Mortars and Turn and Burn and what else?
Renounce the Guilds I gave a check to because sometimes it'll get there.
So really 2 pieces of removal.
Yeah, I think Mizzium Mortars is really well positioned for this coming weekend. It kills a lot of things in the format.
Yeah, that card is sweet.
I mean, and that's only $3.50 right now on paper.
God, remember those were 1?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I sold I did them. Well, but I still think they're going to hit 5.
I think we actually did, we called Mizzium Mortars like 9 months ago.
Yeah.
And they went, and then they went back down and like I bought them when they were low again. Mizzium Mortars is the gift that keeps on giving. Jeff, do you have a mono red card?
I actually don't. I'm going to go a little bit more blue. I enjoy casting counter spells in a non-legacy format. And Prognostic Sphinx is definitely my pick. He's only got one direction he could possibly go.
He's got that sweet-looking Pai Mei beard like that dude from Kill Bill.
He just has a very powerful effect. His stats are well-positioned against the dragon decks. Like, 3-5 gets to block the dragon when it comes down. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it basically has protection as long as you have a card in your hand, it's almost unkillable other than Supreme Verdict.
I mean, this is what I said, too, about the card when I saw it in the set review. And people said, well, you know, it's not Aetherling. Wouldn't you rather just have Aetherling? I mean, what's the difference between the two? You know, why do you not just want Aetherling?
Okay, so here's why you don't just want Aetherling. So the fact that Cavern of Souls has rotated from the format makes Aetherling much harder to stick in a control mirror, which Aetherling is already a minimum of a 7 casting cost spell.
Right.
So now if you add on to the fact that, okay, now I need to be able to, like, have negate or dispel or possibly even dissolve mana up in addition to that 7, so, like, now my control finisher's not coming down until a minimum of turn, like, 8 or 9, like, Prognostic Sphinx, you can, like, slam on 5 if they tap out for something. So, like let's say you're on the play and they play their Jace on 4. Right. On 5, you can untap in Sphinx, and now they have to have Verdict.
Right.
It also gives them a reason, like, post board in a control mirror, are they going to leave Verdict in their deck to deal with the Sphinx?
Yeah, that, I mean, that all makes a lot of sense. That's kind of what drew me to it, is Scry 3 is so many Scrys.
it's really good. Like,
it's all of the Scrys.
A lot of people equate Scrying, like, if you Scry 4, it's the same as drawing a card, and it's really close to true. Like, the number of times, like, attack with Sphinx, like, he doesn't even have to connect, he just has to attack. You're like, well, we're going to take these two lands and put them on the bottom of our deck, and I'll draw the spell.
You feel like you're cheating.
It is, yeah. Like, just don't draw relevant cards for the rest of the game.
So this strikes me as one of those cards that, like, every once in a while, like, you'll play limited, and the card's so good in limited, you have to at least try it and construct it. Is that what happened here? Because every time I've swung with Prognostic Sphinx in a booster draft, it just felt dirty.
I lost this card. It was very frustrating to lose to.
You know, Phil's dirty unlimited is Elspeth. Yeah, that card is unbeatable.
Yes,
that
Marcel, mythics are very good.
That card's a powerhouse in standard too, though. I mean, she pluses to make guys. That's insane. Like, well, it's six mana.
She was nowhere last weekend. Why is that?
What do you mean she was nowhere? She saw play in the deck that took second, and she saw play in the deck that won the TCG Player 5K.
Right. Well, I'm looking at Star City. There were only something like a handful in the top 32.
It's because Mono Red can't play it.
Well, you gotta remember, did none of the Esper decks play it? I thought it was seeing play in the Esper decks in the blue-white deck.
I think Ashiok actually saw more play at the Open in, like, the top 16.
That can't possibly. Yeah, I mean, I believe that would happen, but I think... Yeah, there were... Max Teets had two copies of Elspeth in his second-place deck list.
Yeah, sounds right.
Yeah, you're right. It doesn't look like any of these... That's weird. None of the Esper decks are playing her.
I mean, I thought...
Okay, one of the three Esper decks in the top... The top 16, or the top 8 was playing her.
Do you think the double white's gonna be tough in Esper, or is, like, by the time you get to 6 mana, it shouldn't matter?
Yeah, I think by the time you get to 6 mana, it shouldn't matter. Plus, again, you gotta remember, like, this is a control finisher, so, like, there's gonna be a lot of games where, like, she's really relevant where you're not even playing her on 6. Like, you wanna get to, like, 8 or 9 so you can hold counter magic up to protect her, make sure she sticks.
Sure.
I mean, so do you're not, like, off the Elspeth hype train now that one weekend went by? Do you think it's gonna, you know, continue to see play, or?
Oh, I definitely think it's going to continue to see play. It's a very, very powerful card.
So what about the guys? Which of the guys do you think are constructed playable?
Well, Jeff, do you want to actually talk about... So Jeff has brewed a blue-red deck that actually runs Prognostic Sphinx and one of the gods also, if you wanted to mention that.
Yeah, so I'm playing... It's sort of a mix between... It's not quite tempo, but it's not quite control. It's somewhere in the middle, and that... It depends on the draw you have. We're playing Frostburn Weird, which is another card that I never expected to be constructed playable. It's very, very good. So sometimes you have, like, these aggressive draws where you're like Frostburn Weird on 2, Thassa, God of the Sea on 3, Jace, Architect of Thought on 4, attack you for 5. Like, and you get, like, just this aggressive start. And other times you're like, okay, my hand has Magma Jets and Dissolves and Is It Charms and land in it, and I'm just going to sit here and, like, one for one you a bunch until I stick a Prognostic Sphinx.
And you're running something that actually isn't on your list of removal, which I think is great. And that is a 2-mana or 3-mana enchantment. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your unconventional choice of removal?
Claustrophobia. So one of the things that's on my list of removal is Turn and Burn only kills 92% of creatures. That 8% that it misses involve 1/1 counters. And Claustrophobia doesn't care how many 1/1 counters your creature has, because it's going to stay tapped.
You know, Claustrophobia doesn't hit Obsidian, so that's right.
But Claustrophobia does Devotion.
It does give Devotion, though, too, which is sweet. So, like, you can have Frostburn Weird on 2, Thassa on 3, Claustrophobia tap your blocker on 4, attack you for 6.
That's dirty. How often does that happen?
I mean...
Amounts of times?
It's definitely a non-zero amount of time. You're playing... 3s and 4s of a lot of these cards.
So what's the aim of the Ratchet Bomb? When do you want to blow that up? Is it situation dependent, or is there a line of play that comes up frequently?
Ratchet Bomb's just super flexible in the format right now. You'll see even the blue-white decks are playing a couple of them, and that's because the mono-red decks are really heavy on one-drops, and at the same time, Ratchet Bomb is a house in the control mirror because all of these Esper and blue-white decks are playing Detention Spheres to take out gods and other things that are troublesome. So, like, you just can preemptively tick your Ratchet Bomb up to 3, and then if they play a Jace, you can end step it to 4 and then kill the Jace on your turn.
They won't just de-sphere your bomb?
Well, if they de-sphere your bomb, then the bomb has killed the Detention Sphere.
Excellent. So you've got 3 Hammer Purphoros on the board. That's a card that was not my pick of the week because it hasn't gone up quite as expected. But I bought in around $1.75 on TCG Player. And before anybody price checks me and said, hey, they're 2. Yeah, they're gone at $1.75. I bought them.
I think, so basically, one of the things that's really interesting about this blue-red deck is because it's got some more aggressive draws, unlike the Sphinx's Revelation decks, we don't need a million lands on the table. So it's very common for, like, lands past five, you're either discarding them to Thought Flayers or Prognostic Sphinx, or you're just trying to scry them away. Well, Hammer of Porphyros gives us another outlet to expend all these excess lands in a control mirror, basically turn them into more resources.
Oh, wait, did I hear you right? You said Thought Flare instead of Steam Augury? Well, what's this?
So, I pre-ordered Steam Augurys because I was sold I was going to play this Magic card. And we sleeved up proxy decks and we started testing. And there were a number of times that, I made piles with one card I really wanted and four cards that were completely irrelevant. And my opponent was just like, have your four Magic cards for four mana. And I was like, I want this one though. This is the Magic card I want. And it was just really frustrating. So I think paying the premium of that fifth mana to one, not give your opponent the information about the things you're drawing, and two, being guaranteed to get to the thing you want and being able to do things like hold excess land, so if you draw four pieces of action, you get to keep all of them, is really powerful in a deck like this.
Huh, that makes sense. So do you think Steam Augury is just a bad card, or do you think it's just not for this deck?
I'm honestly not sure. I think if a more aggressive tempo-style deck could come out of blue-red, that would be powerful in there. If your deck's basically like all four ofs and you're just looking to draw a pile of cards and there aren't a ton of lands in your deck, it might be very good, but I don't think anything that's seeing play right now or anything I've been working on really wants to play the card.
Huh. Interesting. I actually like that card a lot, so it's humbling to hear.
So tell me this, Jeff. Obviously, you've done a lot of testing. We expected, and we talked about this the last couple weeks on the cast, to see some blue-white-red control, with Chain to the Rocks hitting a bunch of stuff and still having access to all those cards. You know, what do you think happened there? Do you think that the mana's not there, or, is not having, like, Ashiok in the mirror? Like, what's happening there?
I think, Esper is in the corner singing anything you can do, I can do better, is what it comes down to. Like, they're two very, very similar archetypes, and like you said, blue-white-red loses Ashiok. It gains better removal in the form of Chain to the Rocks, but I think if we go back to my spreadsheet, I think Hero's Downfall was actually killing more than... Yeah, Chain to the Rocks was only killing 84% of the creatures that saw play last weekend, while Hero's Downfall and Dreadbore were killing like 85 and 89%. So like, it's more mana, but it kills more things. So like, Esper having access to Hero's Downfall is huge.
Yeah, that makes sense. Maybe as the metagame shifts, like, Anger of the Gods was supposed to be a big draw to red, white, blue. But it looks like maybe those decks that you wanted that, like green, white was just nowhere to be found. I mean, there were some of the Naya decks, but green, white itself, which is where like, Anger of the Gods really shines, just was not prevalent last weekend.
Anger of the Gods did kill 66% of the creatures that saw play last weekend. So, I mean, you know.
Yeah.
I think part of the problem is too, though, if your deck has access to Anger and Supreme Verdict, how fast does the format really have to be that you want to play Anger over Supreme Verdict?
Right.
That's the question you really gotta ask yourself.
Right. And the double red, when you don't have all the mana fixing available yet, is not always easiest.
And one thing that kind of surprised me personally is that how playable a bunch of these monstrous cards are, which makes Supreme Verdict a lot more relevant.
Yeah.
What about Bestow? Sure. Do you see Bestow even constructive playable?
I don't think it's a stretch to say that the only constructed playable Bestow creature is Boomsayer.
Yeah, that's
I think
my
I agree
thoughts.
With that.
And even then, that's a stretch, kind of.
Yeah, it's definitely a stretch, and anyone that knows me knows I love flashy things, and like the blue-red fairy deck in Modern and the Rug Flash deck I played for a long time last Standard season, so that card's definitely on my radar of things I want to try, but just nothing has stuck out to me so far with it.
It's so damn expensive.
It's a frustrating mechanic in Limited and a unplayable one in Constructed.
Yeah, the Boonsetter, like, it's only saving grace as you can use it as a combat trick.
Yeah.
Like, if push comes to shove, like, worst case scenario, if you get a dude three, a dude through unblocked, it's a Lava X.
I would like to do that on a Fabled Hero. That sounds nasty.
I'll swing for two. Actually, you're dead.
So one of the cards that you're talking about monstrous that may have some legs, is Ember Swallower, and simply because of the fact, I believe, that it's a 4-5, like, 5 toughness is huge.
That card's very good. We green-red with one of the decks in our gauntlet this past week when I was testing with some friends. And like the very real play of like Mana Dork on one, Satyr on two, Swallower on three, Monstrous on four is very real.
Yeah, well, that sounds pretty nasty. yeah, I mean, financially, the problem is that it was obviously available with the pre-release, so everyone has, you know, there's a lot of copies out there, but it's probably not a bad trade target to have in your binder, even if there's not a lot of money to be made, you know, buying. It's probably a good one to make sure you have it available.
They also gave Emrakul and Wurmcarl Engine out at the pre-release.
Well, Mythics.
Yeah, sure, and I think red wasn't as popular as, say, white or even black or blue, so I think you might have some chance at that.
I mean, but those, there were still probably the same number made, right? And then those are probably finding their way to the market one way or another.
That's fair. But then you also have diluted. You got five different play packs, which diluted it similar to the Gills last time.
So how much play do you guys think it would have to see then? And Jeff, do you think it would see enough play?
I think it's unrealistic to think that there's going to be enough demand for that card to, like, based on how much was given out. Like, it's definitely going to see a lot of play, but it's probably not going to be an auto four of in every deck. Like, if you look at all the green-red decks that placed this last weekend, there were only a few that were playing four of it. Like, it competes with World Eater at the four-drop slot.
Yep. Yeah.
Lupin, that's another card that, like, there's a lot of those out there because it's in the dual deck. And the dual deck is probably worth close to $20 without the Pelucranus in there.
So you like Pelucranus. You think that's playable?
Yeah, that card's definitely constructed playable. I mean, the thing you have to remember about it is, let me look up the exact wording so I don't mess it up. It's like green XX to make it monstrous, I believe.
Yes.
Which means that on curve you can like play it on four and then deals X damage. So like, you can play it on four and then do two damage to something on five, which isn't unreasonable, then like attack with your 7/7.
Yeah, that's pretty good. It just kind of sucks with, like, Restoration Angel and all those kind of tricks leaving. Like, once he's monstrous. It would take too much work to reset him, essentially.
I mean, I guess the idea is if you monstrous him, you're going to win because you just killed several dudes on their board and have a giant guy.
Well, that's what Claustrophobia is for.
Right.
So you can, you know, leave him tapped.
Nice 7/7, bro.
It's like, here's your 12-man investment. This is my 3-man investment. Have a nice day.
Well, Jeff, if you weren't a better player than me, I might question you on Claustrophobia, but...
So,
I've been plenty wrong before, but I think the card is fine.
Well, speaking of questioning you, I want to ask you this. I didn't agree with the Lifebane zombies in your rock deck. I thought that Charos Messengers was a better card to play.
Uh-oh.
He said this behind your back, Jeff.
All right, so I want to describe a magic card to you. If I tell you that in your green-black rock deck that needs to push consistent damage through, that I'm going to give you a creature that says 3-mana, 3/1 unblockable, look at your opponent's hand when it enters the battlefield. Would you play that card?
Yes, I would play.
I would play that card. And that card's called Lifebane Zombie. Only occasionally, it won for one of them when it looked at their hand.
Yeah, but then you get the messenger, like against a control deck, you got a threat that's hard to deal with that could live through a mutilate, the damage and pressure, and there's sometimes that the Lifebane, it was just not even a one.
The problem with that at the end of last season is that it was Charos Messenger wasn't better against the blue white red deck, which is the matchup that really needed help. And it was better against the Esper deck for sure. Like, it survived Supreme Verdict, but against the Esper deck they were leaving their Pillar of Flames in against you to kill Scavenging Oozes and Lifebane Zombie or Charos Messenger anyways. So like it was just a one for one against them still.
Okay, that's fair. I mean, you did good with it, and a lot of people copied that, so I'm sure you know what you're talking about. That was just my difference of opinion.
No, I mean, that's the biggest split on, and there were a lot of people I talked to that said, hey, love the list, cut your Lifebane Zombies, played Messengers. The other thing about that was, by the end of last season, I was playing a basic Forest in the deck in addition to two Mutavaults, and that makes Charos Messenger a lot harder to play.
Yeah.
So, one other thing, like, I wouldn't mind touching on, I know we're getting closer to time here, but When I came on before we started the cast, we were talking a little about Modern and, you know, John Dominé and everything. What do we think is the way to attack that? I mean, are the tools there to combat this, or is it going to take a ban?
Okay, so my opinion on Modern as a format as a whole is that I refuse to believe this format has been solved. We have a format with over a decade's worth of cards where essentially almost every deck in it, like Birthing Pod aside, is just a rehash of something that existed in Extended or Standard previously. So, like, I feel like there's something in this card pool that is waiting to be like cracked wide open.
So you're okay. A brewer. You're a hardcore brewer. And do you ever play net decks, or what's your stance on that?
I hate the term net deck. I think net deck is a term that people that just lost to a tier one deck at FNM and are salty use. It's miserable. Like, yes, it's a tier one deck and it's popular because it's good. And one of the ways you get better at Magic and get better at brewing is by playing tier one decks and realizing, well, why is this deck good? Why are they playing these cards? So yes, I've definitely played stock tier one decks before. You learn a lot from that. And it's important, especially like even now in playtesting, like even though I'm going to show up with this blue red deck this weekend, I played a dozen matches with a blue white deck this past weekend. I played a dozen matches with green red on both sides of the table. And like it's important to understand how they work and why the card choices they're making.
But you have more fun going to tournaments, playing your own brews, or what's your
fun? Yeah, okay, so here's my opinion on playing Magic in general. So a player that is very good at Magic wins, say, 70 or 80% of their matches. That means in a 10-plus round event or a Grand Prix that's like 15 rounds, you are going to have to get lucky to top 8 that event. And if you're going to have to get lucky to top 8 the event anyways, you might as well get lucky playing sweet cards and something stock, because like, if you get lucky and you top 8 playing with sweet things, you get remembered way more than if you just like, oh, look, he's the junk reanimator guy.
Like,
I like that argument. Well,
got me sold.
Good way to approach it. I mean, go back to Modern. One of the things that one of the guys from Oklahoma, NGP Detroit, went 8-1 on day one with a red-white stack deck is what we call it. And basically it's like Mages of the Tabernacle, Boom Bust, Ghostly Prison, Avian Mind Sensor, these sort of things. I mean, it is certainly a different angle at which to attack the Jund decks. Because Jund cannot stop you from playing, like, if you land a Ghostly Prison and resolve it or whatever, they can't beat a bust after that. Or, you know, like, Mages of the Tabernacle is very good. I mean, like, so you talk about, it not being solved, like, it's kind of a different way to approach, and I think maybe that's one of the things, because it's very hard to just out card advantage Jund or one for one then, but you have to find maybe a different angle to attack.
So here's the problem with how you're looking at the format. You're talking about how this deck has a good angle to beat Jund. When I build a lot of decks, like the blue red Delver deck that I've been playing for a while now, I tell people all the time, like, they ask me, well, how do you win the blue white red matchup? And my answer is you get lucky or you hope not to play it. And people are like, well, it's one of the most popular decks of Modern. And yes, it is very popular. And that means on a good day, it's 10% of the field. So that means in 15 rounds, you're going to play it 1.5 times. Maybe. I got through all of GP Kansas City, never playing against Affinity and never playing against a Tarmogoyf. 15 sure. rounds of Magic.
Sure.
So you can't build a deck to beat one archetype in a field of 30 archetypes.
But for instance, like Ghostly Prison is good against every single creature deck. It's also good against Splinter Twin Combo, and Pod, and Kiki Pod. It's attacking, I guess the one problem is attacking mana, is kind of the different angle that it takes. I mean, maybe not this particular deck, but do you think like in general, this is kind of a way to approach the format? Because,
I've had a lot of people ask me about prison decks, and that's basically what that is. It's a prison, trying to build a prison deck in Modern, right. like Enchantress is in Legacy right. and things like that. And the problem with Modern is it's so open that it's hard to put a jail around everything. So then the question becomes, well, can I put a jail around a relevant percentage of the field? And I honestly don't think you can. I don't think we have enough powerful card selection and powerful cards in general in Modern to like be able to build an appropriate prison deck like we can in Legacy.
Okay. Well, like I said, it was interesting because my buddy and I know the guy. We haven't been working on it together, but we both kind of independently worked on this deck, based off of a mutual friend we knew who played it back in Old Extended where you would like go Chromox, turn to a Johnny Vengeance. But anyways, and I asked because he went 8-1 on day one at the GP and ended up, I think, top 64. He didn't have a great day too. But like it showed that, I mean, it can have success. So that's why I was asking like on that angle.
Everything's all about matchups. I mean, like, you know, sometimes you're going to play against Birthing Pod 6 rounds in a row. Other times you're going to play against 6 different decks 6 rounds.
Right. So, I mean, but do you think, speaking more general terms, I mean, do you think that that is a way people should approach Modern? Because you talk about it not being a soft format. You know, you think, is that the angle, the approach people who are trying to get out there and brew and trying to, you know, make something happen besides just play Jund, is that a good angle to approach and just looking at kind of different axes of attack? Or do you think that's not the right way?
I think different accesses of attack are always a great way to look at a format to try and, like, you know, break it, so to say. But the important thing about Modern, I think, is that you want your strategy to be a proactive one. You want to be able to punish your opponent when they stumble. You want to be able to, like, have a way, like, having an oops, I win in your 75 is not a bad place to be.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So what is your favorite format to play?
It's so close between Legacy and Modern. Like, there's so many sweet things you can do in both formats. On one hand, like, we get to play with a lot of really powerful cards in Legacy, but on the other hand, I'd almost say that there's more playable cards in Modern because the power level is so much lower. Like, even though there's, you know, two decades worth of cards in Legacy, like, the playable card pool is so small because of the combo decks that we have to fight.
So in Modern, if you had to ban a Modern card and unban a Modern card, what would you do?
I think Seething Song is fine. I think the fact that they've, like, banned all these cards out of Storm is absurd. Like, the deck still kills people on turn three after two bans. Like, give them their Seething Song back.
I mean, they hate Storm, right? That's what it comes down to.
Yeah, they don't like the mechanic. They want every combo deck in the format to be interacted with via Lightning Bolt is what they want. And honestly, banning, I'm not sure the answer is more bans. I mean, my Spellstutter Sprite Reman deck was really happy when they banned Bloodbraid Elf, like, ecstatically happy. But if you've ever had to remand a Bloodbraid Elf because it's going to kill you, you understand how I feel.
So, but if you had to ban a card, what would you ban? Just, you know, just off a...
Like, totally on my personal bias, I hate Tarmogoyf. Who thought, like, a 6-7 for 2 mana was okay?
That's completely fair. You got Deathrite Shaman in the format, right?
Yeah, I guess.
I mean, do you think a lot of people called for Deathrite Shaman's head after Detroit? You think there's any merit to that?
I don't know. Like, I heard just as many people saying Birthing Pod needs to be banned because it won 3 events in a row, and those people, like, you can't just take results from a single event. Like, it's going to have to be consistent over time. The biggest thing that makes me question Jund, though, is the fact that all of these big-name pro players showed up and played this deck, which meant they were all fairly unanimous on the opinion that this is the deck you should be playing in this format.
So what about unbanning? You said Seething Song. Anything else after that?
No, I think that's about it. The problem with, like, something like Preordained to give blue control decks consistency is that it probably makes things like Splinter Twin and Storm way too good.
Okay.
So how can they reach you, Jeff? Is there any other places you write for besides us?
Yeah, I write for you guys every other week. I have a weekly column that I write for the website, deckfactory.com.
Okay.
And, you guys can, follow me on Twitter at Jeff Hoagland, and you can follow me on Twitch for when I go live with streams, DeathStarMTG is the one for that. I'm sure we can get a link to that in the resources.
And is there a schedule for when you stream, or is it just purely you tweet when you go on?
I stream Modern every Wednesday, and I plan to start doing Standard every Tuesday evening.
Is this evening times? Is there a set time? Or?
Yeah, 8:30 Central Standard Time for Modern, and I believe the Standard Daily is at 9 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Sweet. All right. So check them out. See all the. So you usually go and play your Crazy Brews and crushing 4-0s with them?
that's hopefully the idea. Bunch of 3-1s at least. Those are profitable.
Make them Merfolk.
Hey, make that a mission. Make a Merfolk deck and Corbin. How much are you gonna hit? It is a bounty. Sure. Somebody out there, if you guys could do a 4-0 Merfolk deck, please let us know. Or even a 3-1. Even a 3-1.
Actually, I know we're trying to wrap up here, but really quick. Merfolk is actually really popular in Moto because the deck's really cheap to build. It doesn't require fetch lands and doesn't require any expensive things other than like Aether Vials. So you're just like, this is my Modern deck, and it's mono blue. All right, guys. Well, thank you for having me on.
Yeah, man. Thanks for coming on.
No problem, Jeff. Time. Anytime.
I'll be in Cleveland this weekend and then Milwaukee the weekend after that. So if you guys are planning to go to those, feel free to say hi, and I will see you all around.
Are you going to make it to GP Montreal next year?
I'm not sure. My schedule's not done that far out yet.
Well, pencil that in. That's going to be the next GP Vegas. So if you can make it out there, it's going to be awesome.
All right. Catch you later, guys.
Brainstorm Brewery is brought to you by GatheringMagic.com and CoolStuffInc.com. Show your support.
Hey, guys, one thing I forgot to mention is is that I will be at GPOKC this weekend. So if you're there, stop by, say hi. I live in Oklahoma, so it's the first GP we've ever had here in the state. But the really exciting part is that I will be doing official coverage for Wizards on the Mothership on Saturday and Sunday. So keep an eye out for that, and if you're there, say hi. It's going to be a fun time.